617-226-7-1607.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Vietnam, it was a transformative trek into unknown jungle. Not just for the soldiers, but for journalists as well.
Motivate their troops. This is the story of how one unit adjusted to those pressures and to the additional pressures of a change in command. John Lawrence reports, The World of Charlie Company.
Spring, 1970. After 5 years of killing, the gears of the Vietnam death machine were grinding more slowly in the months before the invasion of Cambodia. After 5 years of war, the lives of the line infantrymen, the grunts, were practically the same. Young men with guns, tramping around the tropical jungle, living like the other animals, occasionally engaging in the death game the first grunts were sent here for in 1965.
John Lawrence was a young green reporter when he first headed to Vietnam in 1965. 5 years later, in 1970, he had three tours under his belt. He was a Cronkite favorite, and he wanted to show America what life was really like for the grunts in C Company.
Was there a rebellion today?
You might call it that. Back in the world, they call it rebellion. Here, it's just downright refusal. We had the whole company. CO says, okay, we're going to walk through it. And the whole company says, no, negative. We've heard too many companies, too many battalions want to walk the road. And that's why they aren't what they are now. They're getting blown away.
Lawrence left Vietnam after that for good, but it stayed with him as it has for so many people. And though it took him numerous attempts over three decades, he has published his memoir. It is called The Cat from Hue. It is, he says, his life's work. Connection listeners, the soul searching about that small Southeast Asian country goes on. Why is that? Why do we keep returning to Vietnam? Are there still lessons to be learned? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. And over the course of the next hour, if you check in on our website, you'll be able to see photographs of John Lawrence at work in Vietnam. We're putting those up now, and John Lawrence is in the studio with me. He is the author of Cat from Hue. Welcome.
Thank you.
I heard in your voice when you're talking about the gears of the Vietnam death machine, a real exhaustion. Now, was that done in the field at the time when you were as worn out as you sound?
It was done in the field near the end of our filming with a squad, 2nd Platoon of C Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, 1st Cavalry Division. And I wasn't particularly exhausted physically. We were living with these 12 guys outside of Phuc Vinh a couple of miles on what was called Palace Guard. And it was very easy, light duty at the time. My producer, Russ Bensley, back in New York, had encouraged me strongly, meaning he had ordered me to do an on-camera for the documentary. But he hadn't suggested what kind of on-camera. I've always been reluctant to go on-camera in television news reports because I think that we work in a visual medium and the pictures of the event tell the story best. But in this case, they insisted, and so I sat down by a tree. I borrowed somebody's M16 because I felt safer away from the group having it next to me, even though I didn't know how to shoot it, and wrote that open one morning and then came back. And as I read it, my cameraman, Keith Kay, immediately after reading it, asked me to sit down with the squad. This was really weird. And read it aloud to them again. Precisely as we had just done it on camera? Yes. Just read it aloud to them again, and he was rolling on me and them reading it. And then he asked them, how true was what Lawrence just wrote to what you've been living? And they all said, oh, right on, man. That's it. You got it. That's right. That's fine. Way to say it. Way to go. And he included that with the film that went back to New York so that the producers would know that it was accurate, at least in the eyes of the soldiers.
Your work was always a collaboration with your crew. You learned the television craft from one of your first camera operators. That's not the way that most war correspondents learn the craft, is it?
No. Normally, you've developed your skills as a television reporter somewhere in the States, and then are sent abroad, as is the case with most newspapers and other journalists. But in this case, I was sent as the radio reporter for CBS News in August of 1965. And when I got there, my very first assignment was with a Vietnamese silent cameraman to go cover a new convoy. And while out in the field, I discovered that the bureau chief had sent another camera crew, a very good one, an ace combat crew, who had also just arrived in country at the other end of the convoy. So we were supposed to meet in the middle somewhere, and they expected an ambush that actually never happened. The reason that I learned in the field was because Morley Safer had been assigned this camera crew, but had already found a good Vietnamese camera person that he chose to work with. So they were left with this spare, excellent combat crew, Jim Wilson and Bob Funk, and this 25-year-old reporter who had only done radio as experience, and they just married us up, and the cameraman taught me the ways to do it.
You brought a little piece of tape in that we're going to listen to. This is a conversation that you're having with a doctor, and one of the reasons why I wanted to hear some of this, John, is that as in reading the book, I was struck just by how close to combat you were on a regular basis as a reporter. You're not taking briefings. You're not sending your camera operator out to get the film and bring it back to the tent so you can write the script. You're there. And maybe you can just tell us what we're about to listen to, put us in the picture.
There was a North Vietnamese attack on one of the first CAV fire bases in War Zone C, in the dogshead of War Zone C, in April of 1970. It was a very powerful attack. I think 24 American soldiers were killed, more than in Mogadishu, by the way, in 1993. And this was routine. This happened. And I took an ammo resupply helicopter by myself and my tape recorder and my notebook into the base while it was under attack. And I just went around the base interviewing people, soldiers. The colonel had been wounded four times, the commander of the battalion. And I ended up talking to the battalion doctor, the battalion surgeon, who was a draftee, by the way, and didn't really have his heart in being in Vietnam as a combat.
It's a terrible thing to see men that have been wounded and then die. And unfortunately, I had to watch two or three of them die down here tonight because we just don't have anything to help them out here on the fire support base. Just a terrible experience is all I can say. Well, it's just terrible to see young men die.
John Lawrence in Vietnam with his tape recorder. Ever since Vietnam, whether we're talking about Kosovo or the Gulf or Afghanistan, the word Vietnam comes up. The word Vietnam always comes up because it's bad. It's what we don't want to have happen again. So you look back on your time as a correspondent, trying to explain what was going on there. What do you make of the shorthand that it was all bad, that everything was wrong, that the soldiers shouldn't have been here, that the politicians and the generals had it wrong, and that Vietnam just stands for mistake?
Pretty much so. The mistake was in our perception of a number of factors about Vietnam that the government got wrong, that the leaders of the country, including the military, simply did not understand. And that was the degree of resistance that the Vietnamese were capable of putting up. Those who honestly believe that the Vietnam War could have been won never consider the possibility that it wasn't ours to win. we didn't belong there because the war was really between the Vietnamese themselves. It was a war of liberation, a war of independence, not unlike our own. And the Vietnamese who actually won the war were those who were most committed to the long-term job of making Vietnamese free of foreign interference or domination or whatever you want to call it. This is not a political point of view. This is an historical point of view. And that's what I came to believe after 5 years of witnessing much of the killing and the rest that went on.
Was there a turning point, John? You say in 1965 you went over there, you believed everything that anyone told you. But was there a point? Was there a sort of Walter Cronkite Tet Offensive turning point for you?
I think it was an accumulation of lies in Vietnam, in Washington, and Saigon. As a reporter, you must know yourself, Dick, that you are always trying to find the deepest truth in a story that you can. Sometimes you don't always get to that level of deeper truth, and you have to settle for as much as you can find out that you can verify is factually correct. Okay. You do that as a reporter. But you're always thinking in your mind, if I could just find out from a few more people what was really going on in that conference room or that cabinet office or in the Oval Office, wherever it was. When you discover that people have been lying to you, to your face, week after week, month after month, year after year, and you can see with your own eyes in the field what's truly going on, you get angry, you get frustrated, you believe that deceit is the real actor in the play, and you respond. You know, your reporting starts to reflect that. And that's what happened to me, and it happened to many of the journalists in Vietnam.
Did you lose your objectivity?
In the end, I was so bitter about the killing, not just of good American lives, but also of thousands of Vietnamese who had played no part in the war at all, other than to have been born Vietnamese and have lived in their villages and tried to live a peaceful life, as the Vietnamese are doing today. I say in the book that I heard a news report at the after the war was over, and it was a senior U.S. representative in Hanoi. He was a consular official of some kind, and he'd been a veteran of the war. He'd been an officer in the war. And he was telling a reporter, a British reporter for ITN, that all of the changes in Vietnam toward commercialism and capitalism, which were evident everywhere, the skyscrapers, the hotels for business people, all the facilities of communication and the rest of Vietnam that it's become today economically, were reflected in a quote of his to the interviewer. He said, this American ex-officer said, "You know, it would have been a lot easier if they just let us win."
What was your reaction when you heard that?
I thought it was profound and funny and ironic.
Make you angry?
No. I'm not angry about the war anymore.
Some you sure are in the book.
Yes. Yes. The book reflects as much as I could the way I felt and behaved at the time. So as I relived it in the writing of it, The Cat from Hue reflects other people's feelings, behavior, observations. All of it is I try to recapture the time.
Connection listeners, what are your feelings? What are your observations? We'd like to have you join our program. We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guest is John Lawrence. His book is called The Cat from Hue. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on National Public Radio.
At 11:22.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour with John Lawrence about his memoir and reporting from Vietnam. The book is called The Cat from Hue. You're welcome to join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to listen to a member of Charlie Company. It's from John's 1970 award-winning documentary, The World of Charlie Company. This man, Doc Howe, has chosen to be a medic so he won't have to be a rifleman.
See, you were supposedly withdrawing, right? And, I figure since we're going home in the long run, why don't we just sort of take it easy, you know? Don't go out looking for trouble, just sort of, you know, maybe sit down. If they come to us, we'll fight, maybe, you know. But going out looking for trouble, and wasting more lives for just time's sake, It, to me, is just absurd. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. It could be. I like to say that I won't, you know, fire or shoot anybody. But then you always got the little thing back in your mind. Well, what if all of a sudden one day there's a gook and he's got this AK pointed at you? I mean, wow. If I ever do have to kill somebody, I think I'd go insane afterwards. So. Because of conscience thing. Wow, I killed somebody. Oh, wow. I just hope it never happens.
That's from The World of Charlie Company. It's a television documentary produced by John Lawrence, who is with me in the studio, and we're talking about a book that he's written called The Cat from Hue. The Cat from Hue. It's just a kitten you pick up in a house that's blown apart in Hue at one of those moments of real kind of despair in a place like that. Why does the cat then have that kind of importance to you?
At the time it happened, which was February of 1968, during the Battle of Hue in the Citadel on the 20th day, I was exhausted. I was overdue to go home. I'd finished my second tour of duty in Vietnam, and I was just staying on because CBS didn't have enough people there to cover the war properly. And I was paranoid and skittish and kind of a bit like nervous as a cat. And if you believe that meetings are never by chance between people or animals or whatever it may be, as I do, the meeting with the cat was significant for me. It took my mind off the terrible bloodletting that was going on in Hue. I've always loved animals. My parents loved animals. My brothers love animals. It's just in the family. And so I gave some food to this starving, orphaned, homeless, flea-infested kitten, about 8 weeks old, size of your hand. And it remembered, so that the next day when I saw it, I think I say in the book, the cat looked like I felt. It remembered. And I ended up making the decision to seize the cat. Well, the cat didn't really want to be seized by this American who looked like a Marine, smelled like a Marine, didn't carry a weapon, but could have been a Marine. And so he began to resist. I mean, he clawed a hole in my chest trying to get away. But I had, anyway, had him down securely. And I describe in the opening chapters of the book how the cat and I managed to get out of Hue under fire, and just how elegant he was and how brave he was under all that fire. And I respected him for that. The reason the book is called The Cat from Hue, and the reason the cat plays a not insignificant part in the book, is because he represents the Vietnamese in the book. He is the symbol, in many, many ways, of the people who won the war. I didn't know any Viet Cong or NLF members or North Vietnamese. I didn't know any soldiers on the other side. And I thought it was important to have one in the book. And so the cat represents, because he did turn out to be VC, and we recognized it at the time, because every time he met an American white-skinned person, he attacked it. He set ambushes for me in the hotel. He tried in devious ways to make my life uncomfortable, but mainly by biting and scratching. And he stayed that way for years, at least until the war was over. So he's he's symbolic of the resistance.
This cat comes back to Connecticut and ends up staying with your family for, what, 13 years or something. Is that right?
Mostly in London.
In London.
After going to London.
Your daughters know the cat. They know less about Vietnam. A bit about the book here. Part of the book is for them, is for the generation that doesn't know Hue. Is that right?
Yes. I was very conscious of the fact that my children knew almost nothing about the Vietnam War and were asking questions about it, but I couldn't describe with any accuracy what it felt like to be a reporter in Vietnam and to become a soldier, as we did in the end. By just spending so much time with the soldiers, by living with them, by showing their daily lives, by interviewing them and all the rest, by making a documentary about them, which was Charlie Company. And so I'm, as the writer and the narrator, It was uppermost in my mind that this should also be a pocket history of the war. It's not a history, it's a memoir, and a very personal one, and I go deeply into my own feelings and problems in resolving the dilemmas of carrying the memories of the war around with me, consciously and unconsciously, and also the solution to them, because I did find a solution. It's no longer difficult for me to talk about the battles that I covered in Vietnam. There was a process of catharsis, if you wish, of purging the old demons from Vietnam out of my soul, out of my memory.
And that's something that I think the book tells me about Vietnam that I didn't know before I read it, and that was that as a reporter in that place at that time, it was important for you to know the names of the soldiers. Obviously, you did it in your documentary, but even in your battlefield encounters, it was their stories. It was you and them face to face. And I don't think if we, review what we know of U.S. military encounters in past years, whether or not we're talking about, the Gulf or Afghanistan, and I don't want to get, lost in that. I want to talk about Vietnam, that happens to that extent. I'm wondering if that's a little bit of what John Lawrence was doing in his subversive way in trying to tell a story of the war that you wanted told, that it was their story and the soldiers, and that was the way you got to get your opinion across.
In the end, it was. You're right, Dick. I did want the American people to see as much of the devastation the war was causing to our side and to the Vietnamese. Each of us carries a streak in us that is basically humanitarian. And, and the scientists will tell you that human beings are caring people. And the better off we are, the more we tend to care for people who are less well off. It's just our humanitarian nature for most people. Not everybody, but most of us are like that. And as a reporter, I felt like that. I always sympathize with the underdog and the dispossessed and the homeless and those who suffered when it was not caused by themselves. But when I went to Vietnam, at first I was very much in support of the war. I thought it was the right war at the right time in the right place. I was very pro-military. I was pro-government. I went to report the winning of the war. I thought we were going to win it. I actually did. But at the same time, I was also a journalist. And to me, the story in Vietnam was the story of the American soldiers up against it. And those very early stories that I did were very sympathetic. The first story I covered, a pregnant woman was killed, a Vietnamese woman was killed by an American-thrown hand grenade. And I reported that as sympathetically as I could to the American soldiers who caused it. That was the way I felt until in 1967, when I went back for my second tour, and I went up to the front with the Marines in Con Tien and Khe San and all those other awful places. And at that point, I was trying to show just how painful it was for our boys. And it was painful. Con Tien and Khe San were awful, dreadful places, scary places. And even some of the Marine officers there wondered what in God's name Westmoreland was doing, ordering the border posts defended. So if you believe that it's biased to go to a war and show the killing, and if you believe that I was biased in a political way, that I was trying to change people's perceptions of whether the war was right or wrong, then I accept that. Yes, that's what I was trying to do as a reporter.
1970, the world of Charlie Company. This is the voice of John Lawrence.
For most of them, for those who are not shot up or blown away by bullets and mortars and rockets, Vietnam is 12 months of physical torture, endless hours of forced marching, sweating under the tropical Asian sun, grunting and groaning in the harness of a 90-pound pack, soaking in the rains of the monsoon, fighting off insects and crawling lizards, swallowing tasteless food crammed into cans, nursing the infected skin sores called jungle rot, collapsing every day with blistered feet and cramped muscles.
1-800-423-8255. Connection Listeners brings you into conversation with John Lawrence, who's just published his memoir. It's called The Cat from Way. We're going to Sudbury, Massachusetts. Wally's on the line. Hi, Wally.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. You know, sometimes when you're in a war, you can see a thousand things and remember them all, but one thing stands out. I was there in very early years, from 1966 to 1967, and I had about 2 months left after a 10-month tour in the field, where I was just outside of Way, so I was assigned to a bodyguard detail for general officers, and I was in Way at the MACV compound. At the time, it was only maybe about 100 Americans. It wasn't a very, it was a city that didn't have, virtually had no military soldiers per se, a lot of civilian advisors, et cetera. But what stuck out in my mind one time was I was assigned to a general officer that was, I was asked to escort him around Way and show him, you know, the highways and the byways of it. And we came to an intersection, and there must have been two or three dozen South Vietnamese young men, very well dressed. Very well dressed, and they were operating the automobiles and these motor scooters. And he just stood there in amazement. He turned to me and he says, "My God," he says, "look at all these young South Vietnamese men." He said, "What are they doing here?" He said. He said, "You got 5 miles outside away. You got young American boys and South Vietnamese peasant soldiers dying." So, out of all the things that you know, I did see there and participated in, that sticks out in my memory, probably will to the day I die. That's just an observation, and I'll take my I'll take your reply off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Wally.
You know, it was possible to buy your way out of combat service in Vietnam as well as it was here in the United States. If you had money, you could bribe someone in New York City for about $150 or $200 and get deferred from regular army service. And the same was true in Vietnam. If your parents had influence or paid the right price, you didn't have to serve in the army. And those people are the ones that Wally saw standing around in the streets of Hue. They were all over Saigon.
Did you feel kind of like you were part of a spectacle for them, you, the soldiers, the fighting?
I guess you might call it a spectacle for them. I think that they somehow felt superior to us. I don't know why. I don't know why that happens. But they used to, when I walked by, even in civilian clothes on the sidewalks of Saigon, spit just in front of my feet. I think in the book I say, you could walk from one end of Tudor Street to the other on a film of spit some days.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Natick, Massachusetts. David, you're joining the conversation. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to call to say I listened to 10 o'clock and knew you were going to have this show on, and I wondered what this guy's spin was going to be on the war, because I served there. And as I've been listening to him, I find it as an accurate description, and his conclusions to be exactly the same conclusions that I came to while I served there. And to give an example, I remember walking through a village. I was in the infantry. I was in the field the whole time. And I remember walking through a village, I think my second or third week in Vietnam, and the people in the village were not in it. They knew we were coming, and they went and hid. And because of that, as I walked around that village, I got a real sense of what this was like, what their life was like. And it was like they came right up out of the ground, and their life did. And I knew that that's where the Viet Cong came from. And I knew that there was just no way we could defeat that. And I remember walking out of that village and thinking, we can't beat this. American imperialism or whatever it was just can't defeat this kind of thing any more than you can defeat the wind.
How old were you at the time, David?
I was 22.
And do you have any recollection of reporters like John Lawrence being around at the time?
We had one. I remember one reporter that was with us for a little while, but I saw him, and he was a little overweight, and I knew that he wasn't going to last long, and he didn't last more than about 4 or 5 hours with us. But that's the only one I really remember.
Because one of the things that John's book points to, in a strong way for me, because I've been in some of the same sort of situations that he has, is that at that time, in those circumstances, there was more of a camaraderie between soldiers like yourself and people like John who had come over to try and tell the story.
Right. Well, I think John paid his dues, and I think that had he been with us out in the field, we would have known that, and so we would have accepted him.
That was a big part of it, John, wasn't it, paying your dues?
It was. I had read a lot of Ernie Pyle before I got to Vietnam, just as a kid, and I'd listened to Edward R. Murrow with my family in World War II, broadcasting from London, and so it was just natural for me to try to show the way that the GIs and Marines lived in Vietnam in an honest way. And in the end, I feel that, along with other reporters, we were the link between the average soldier in the line, the grunt, as they were called, and the folks back home, particularly their families. And so we'd be with a unit for a day or a few days or however long, and we'd tell their story or as much of it as we could. And I explain this in much greater length in the book, the relationship between us reporters and the GIs, particularly the privates and Spec 4s and sergeants, to be able to show, to create a link.
But there's always that question. You're on your way out, and there's that question. When's this going to be on?
Yes, always.
Not like they had a cell phone and they could call their mother and say, watch Walter next Thursday. But they did want, in a way, to know that you, your camera, were in some way validating their presence there, right?
That's what happened. And they would get letters back from their family and friends later, including the officers, saying, so-and-so had a nice report on CBS News. I'm glad to see that you're okay and the rest of it. Or, I'm sorry you have to be in such a tough place right now. My prayers are with you.
And you also got flack from reporters who didn't draw that same sort of favorable response as well.
Sometimes we did, yeah.
All right, David, thanks a lot for your call. Connection listeners, my guest this hour is John Lawrence. He has a memoir that he's been writing for about 30 years on and off, and it's called The Cat from Way, part adventure story, part history of that time, and some insight into what it's like to have been a reporter there and to be looking back at it now. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like your thoughts, your observations of that time and the way that we look back on it now. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is John Lawrence. His memoir is called The Cat from Hue. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We welcome you to call us. We're going to Salem, New Hampshire, and Mike, who's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Question for Mr. Lawrence. I did not serve in Vietnam, but I ended up in a situation where the guys would come home. They're all my age, and in school, we just gave them some place to get away from it. When I left school, I went to work in a factory, and guys that hit SFO, they would hop a plane, be home, show up at the doors 2 days later, and try to get the grace panties out of their feet and back into civilized worlds, and we just kind of faked it. The transition for a lot of these guys was very hard, I would think. Some of them just never made it back. And I was wondering how Mr. Lawrence got home. And I think you know what I mean, Steve, don't you?
You know what he's talking about, actually getting home, not
yes.
Physically, but...
Yes. I didn't have a home for a long time, much less find one, because my job meant going to strange places. I virtually lived in Belfast. I mean, I literally lived in Belfast for 6 months in 1971 and covered the war there and the war in Israel in 73 and the war in Bangladesh in 71. It was one war after another. And to come home, meaning to come back to London where I was based, was just a temporary rest to get my wits about me before being sent off somewhere else. I also covered lots of other stories, too, and I had a wonderful wife, and we raised a family, and the cat lived among us, or ruled, as the case may have been. I didn't come home from the war in Vietnam until I finished writing this book, and it was edited. And as a result of having relived those experiences in my 20s, as a man in his 50s, I was able to see them from the perspective of a mature human being. But I had to relive it as I was describing it. And being older and becoming a writer, as I had to learn to be to write this book, I could see things now that I didn't see then. We were always out in the field talking about what the big picture might be, because you could never see the big picture. You could never see the grand strategy. We knew there was one, even though it may have been failing. But we didn't understand all of the things that were going on. And that's soul-destroying. That really can be unsettling and disconnecting. And that was the truth for many of my colleagues, other journalists in Vietnam. So the answer to your question, Mike, is that I've come home now. I live in rural England. I've got a whole bunch of cats. I'm way out in the countryside where it's peaceful and quiet. I live a really nice, peaceful existence, and I'm at rest with myself.
Answer your question, Mike.
Just one quick follow-up. Do you see the American professional military that you covered in Vietnam, do you see any traces of that in the current professional military, the military of the Powell and the Schwarzkopf and of the LTs and caps of NA that are now coming through? I mean, do you think there's been a fundamental change in the way the military views these types of incursions, such as we were talking about earlier in the Philippines?
Yes and no. And here's why. I have friends who are active in the military, in all kinds of units, and we keep in touch by email. And some of them are in Afghanistan, and some of them are doing things that I won't know about for a couple of years. And they have learned lessons from the Vietnam War that are that go very, very deep into my heart. That is, I hear resonance of what we learned in Vietnam in the way that these 25, 35-year-old young men and women now think. And one of the lessons is that a soldier is a soldier is a soldier. That doesn't change. Tactics may change. Strategies may change. Weapons change constantly. Government official attitudes toward casualties change. For example, we've had such low casualties in Afghanistan and in Kosovo and in the Gulf War before that, largely as a result of throwing the well-being of the men and their lives to the winds in Vietnam. I remember when Charlie Beckwith came back from Iran after trying to lead Desert One into a rescue operation, saying at the National Press Club after it was all over, to a very hostile question from a civilian, "Why didn't you just go on in there into Tehran and take those hostages out of there?" And Charlie Beckwith, the man who founded Special Operations Group Delta Force, said, "Because I saw too many good men die for no reason in Vietnam." I think that our whole appreciation of the lives of our soldiers has been affected by Vietnam. And I take you through it in the book, in particular, Beckwith's first operation as commander of Delta, first serious operation, in the relief of the camp at Ple Mae, which led to the Ao Drang Valley battles. I have great respect for people in the military today, as I did then. I have no disrespect at all if they're well-led, well-motivated, and going for a good purpose. And personally,
but the other point that you make is that in Vietnam, there were a lot of soldiers who didn't want to be there, kids who wouldn't fire their guns.
We now have a professional army, largely as a result of what happened in Vietnam.
1-800-423-8255. Mike, thanks for your call. We're going to Laurinburg, North Carolina. And Lisa, hi.
Hi there. You have invited us to look back on Vietnam, but I really don't know how to look back on Vietnam. I'm 35 years old, and I really don't know anything about that war. I think I had a typical education. I'm college educated, and I even had a brother who fought and was wounded in Vietnam, but yet I really don't know why we were there, and I don't know why we lost. I don't even know if we really did lose, and I'm wondering if that's typical. I guess I'm a member of the generation that doesn't know way, as you mentioned earlier, and I don't know if my teachers were ashamed of the war, or did they not understand why we were at war? I mean, am I typical in that regard?
I think you are. My friends who live in the States tell me that the war isn't taught very thoroughly in the schools here in the States. Lisa, if I may be so immodest, I had you in mind when I wrote this book. And it explains the inception of the war, the conception of the war, both politically and militarily, all the way through to the end of the war, and then the follow-up when I go back to Vietnam in 1982. I'm not trying to pitch the book or anything, but I will tell you that if you want to understand it, I hope that what I've been able to do here in writing my memoir, which covers so many years in the war, you would begin to get a clearer understanding of why we went and what happened to us.
You do some. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, I guess I'll have to muster up my courage because I have a feeling that it's been very comfortable for me to not know about that war.
No, I'm glad you raised the point as well, because one of the things that John does in the book is he refers back to poets who were trying to come to terms with what it meant to be in the First World War trenches.
Uh-huh.
And there's some kind of connection, John, that you are making about putting that kind of horror situation, circumstances, people into words for me, for Lisa, for people. What's the connection that you're making there?
There's a parallel between the tragedy of World War I, which was just a slaughter of a whole generation of European young men for no reason at all, and the fighting in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s. I won't go into it in detail, but it's apparent from the writing in the book that this was our tragedy. But I'll also say this. A number of friends of mine who are women have read the book and read it from cover to cover and have not experienced an abhorrence. The violence isn't so graphically described that it makes you turn away and not be able to finish the book. I was conscious of the fact that people who had never been in combat might find it difficult to read. I don't pull punches, but I do try to give you as honest and as graphic a picture of what it's like to be in combat. But also there's the cat, and there, a good friend of mine, a photographer from Vietnam, Horst Voss, said to me as I started to write this book, Jack, don't forget to leave out the good times, too. So the good times are in there, the down times, the social times, the parties, and there's a love story, too, because I fell in love during the period that I was in Vietnam.
One of the things that you do with some considerable regularity when you're in those battle zones, in the trenches, with the soldiers, is that you leave. You leave them behind. You're looking for the next chopper out as soon as you've got the footage that you need to tell your story. And you dwell on that in a way that makes it clear to me that there's some discomfort there. That, in fact, you recount a couple of conversations with people who say, oh, yeah, sure, you can leave. Part of me thought in reading the book that part of your coming home, part of your exercising whatever demons that you have from your time there was an opportunity to, by virtue of your having been an observer, to, in a way, kind of compensate for that, that there's still guilt attached to the fact that for however bad it may have been for you, it was a whole lot worse for the other people there.
They had no choice, and we did. We journalists did. There were some reporters, and I'll just mention one in particular. Catherine Leroy was a little tiny 4 feet 11-inch French photographer, who stayed with the Marines right through the Battle of Hue. From day 2 to day 26, Kathy was in there taking pictures for Perry Match and Life magazine. And it was extraordinary. She would just, you know, hand us her film and say, make sure it gets to my office in Saigon and stay with the guys. We couldn't do that. Our batteries wouldn't last that long. Our brains wouldn't last that long. Psychologically, it was very difficult to take. But also, we had to, I mean, we took risks to get the footage and tell the story, but it, I think, would have been insane for us to stay for the sake of staying. I don't feel guilty today, because what was the alternative? To stay and get killed, perhaps, certainly the odds would have increased greatly if we had stayed with the unit, just to be able to say we're staying with the unit. But you're right, and I described the guilt in the book, how it felt to sign off from a piece, John Lawrence, CBS News, caisson, when we were probably safely back in the rear in Da Nang somewhere, and the folks back home would get the impression that we were in the combat base with the Marines, taking it day after day after day, when we might have only been in there for a few hours.
Early on, you witness an airstrike, which you think is in Vietnam. It turns out to be Cambodia. You don't report that. You have the chance to report it, and you don't, because you're in that other John Lawrence skin that, you know, thinks that you're actually a part of helping win the war. You talked yourself about being a bit of a booster for what it was. So when we talk about what you had to get out of your system by putting this down on paper, is that getting rid of some of that involvement, which you look back on now with distaste?
As I say, I've had the catharsis. I've relived this episode and many others. But let me tell you specifically about this one. We were invited by the Air Force to go on a combat airstrike. We fly with the Air Force in A1Es. We drop bombs on people. We see them standing in their rice fields as our pilots shoot them up with 20-millimeter cannon. And I ask my pilot, who was the leader of this team, a major, why they don't run? Why don't they don't get out of the way? If they were VC, they'd have run, but they're not running, and you're shooting.
In fact,
they're
looking up at you with surprise.
And he says, "Dumb bastards don't know any better." The dumb bastards don't know. And when we get back to Saigon, we discover that there's a good possibility we were in Cambodia, because the head of state has complained in the United Nations that we, you know, bomb, and we check, and my Air Force contacts, good men, honest men, say to me, "Jack, we just can't tell you. We just better let this one go." And they're essentially saying to me, "We can't tell you anymore. You probably were." And I didn't go with the story. And I felt terribly guilty about that for years afterward. But I was trying to keep in good with the Air Force. I might need their help sometime. And that's the way a journalist operates with sources and officials all the time. What are you willing to trade? The ability to keep on covering the story, or tell the story as it is and suffer the consequences?
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank
John
you.
Lawrence, the book is The Cat from Hue. This is The Connection on National Public Radio.
Girl, there's a better life for me and you.